every generation, I feel like, moves further and further away from...
Marquesa Finch didn't take the traditional route to the top because she wasn't interested in the top. She was interested in truth.
Is something that hasn't been seen in the world before.
From leading billion-dollar strategy transformations at J.P. Morgan to co-founding a fund that's shifting the venture capital landscape for underestimated founders, Marquesa has been at the intersection of capital, culture, and community her entire career.
I think that's something we just don't prioritize enough, but then you end up paying for it because it really can change the way that we live, work, and play.
Marquesa Finch, welcome to The Global Affair. I have some exciting announcements to make to everyone listening today. We actually have our Chief of Science, Dr. Kaushik Ram, who is co-hosting this episode. And this is a conversation I know Kaushik and I have been wanting to have for a while, especially tapping into some of the talent and the intelligence on our research and ethics board, which Marquesa is actually a part of. Otherwise known as an impact VC and a fintech founder, is the co-founder of an amazing organization called Perium, and sits on the IC actually of one of the funds that backed Intruth in the early days. So shout out to F5. Marquesa, it's a total pleasure to have you with us. Today we're going to be talking about the importance of sovereign data infrastructure. I know one of your other roles has been a deep involvement with the Blockchain Society in the Bay. And so I'd love to, you know, go into that and sort of understand why you believe in blockchain as a potential infrastructure for the future. And then, of course, guide the conversation into the risks and the possibilities associated with biotechnology. So I'll pause there and just say welcome. And how's it going today? I know it's a busy day over there in the States.
It is. Well, thank you for having me. I'm really excited to be having this discussion around data privacy, especially in the age of blockchain and AI. And especially excited to talk about it in the vein of Intruth's work with emotions and emotion technology. So I will just give the 2 seconds on myself and why this particular board was especially important to me and why I felt compelled to participate. I am a VC by training. So I started my VC work here in Silicon Valley, where I'm from. I'm also part-time in New York. And largely have focused on digital health and how that affects, I should say, the impact of digital health on our communities, especially focused on the social determinants of health. So those are the health factors of where we live, work, and play, not necessarily the delivery of services, but how everything else in your life, everything from the zip code you live in to the family dynamic that you have, and even your level of education, how that affects your health. So that's largely where I started my career, both in product development and then in venture capital, and then moved into blockchain via healthcare, via digital health, in understanding and supporting companies who were leveraging blockchain for healthcare, which is where I started my blockchain career. Most notably recently with the F5 Collective, which is a female founders fund based in Australia, and with Perium, which is an equity crowdfunding portal that is meant to engage and galvanize and activate retail investors, specifically within affinity groups, to be their own angel syndicates and back companies that they believe in. So with that said, I'm happy to be here, happy to share my thoughts on data sovereignty and, you know, what that means in this age of AI and blockchain.
Fantastic. Thank you for such a comprehensive introduction. We're excited to dive in more deeply. But actually, Kaushik has never introduced himself to our audience. So I'd love, Kaushik, for you to just give a quick background as well and maybe speak to why the Research and Ethics Board that we've put together at Intruth, why that's important to you and how you see kind of responsibility in building biotechnologies.
Yeah, absolutely. And just the framing of this conversation has been quite profound for me in itself, because how often do you find, a tech founder, a neuroscientist, and a
venture capitalist?
Yeah, capitalist in the conversation, which, to be honest, is what happens a lot behind closed doors. but you do, like in a public facing conversation, that is quite rare. So on that note, just a very brief background on my professional direction. I started in animal behavior in zoology and neuroethology, which is the study of animal behavior. So my background really was an interest in evolution and evolutionary biology. And after a few years in that, my undergrad, postgrad, and master's, I moved on to neuroimaging. Started looking at how the brain is wired in psychiatric conditions using MRI, and moved on to neurology after that, where I was involved in a large-scale infrastructure project where we used machine learning to map lesions in multiple sclerosis. So we trained the ML to do that, and then it was able to diagnose and do follow-ups on disease progression in multiple sclerosis. So I've had quite a broad-ranging, understanding in the landscape of neuroscience, from neurosurgery all the way into brain imaging, psychiatry, and neurology. So with that background, what I was coming across so often was there was a huge gap between disease progression and understanding of what disease is and how we treat it. And we often, especially in psychiatric conditions, treat symptoms rather than the root cause. And this brings me to, you know, the same diagnosis that I have in the technology world, where I think, especially in the past, the mentality has been we build first and deal with consequences later. And when you look at the sort of big five tech companies, you know, Microsoft, Apple, Google, Meta, you know, they all have this idea of providing services for free. And so users, you know, they've got user bases in the billions, and the way they make money has been selling that data. And so what's crucial about data mining has been the behavioral or consumer behavior, the insights. And when I think about Intruth, which uses biometric data to extract emotion, I feel by definition of emotional health, we have the responsibility for harm reduction. So we, like, by definition, can't build first and deal with consequences later. So this is where the Intruth Research and Ethics Board comes in, which is part of the research and innovation arm, as well as harm reduction and AI for good philosophy that we are going towards. So when building technology, and we have to have an understanding of innovation and impact in equal measure. And this is the responsibility of the Research and Ethics Board. And we have some incredible, you know, board members that we will probably get a chance to have on this podcast as well. And I can't wait for that. But yeah, as part of this conversation, I think it's really powerful to have to kick off with Marquesa and basically bring in the idea of data sovereignty and this this pathway where I see the future of humanity traveling towards the ability to not only share personal health data, but also have agency on what you share.
Thank you for that, Kaushik. I mean, my sentiments, obviously, we feel exactly the same way about these things. And I think it's nice for these listeners to hear it from you. But Marquesa, you know, going off what Kaushik's just shared around the importance of balancing innovation and impact, I think that that's a really nice kind of way to frame the discussion today as well. You obviously, in Silicon Valley, you see the reality of data brokers and the extraction of data being used as the ultimate kind of way to value companies, the way that shareholders drive, you know, many CEOs to move companies in that direction, because that's where the value often sits in tech companies. Give us a bit of a landscape of that and how and if that sort of pushed you towards your interest in solutions like blockchain.
Absolutely. So the short answer is absolutely yes. the longer answer, and I mean, I have to give a little bit of background too about why this is so important to me. So For one, what I didn't mention in my background is I started off my career as a health professional. I have my master's in public health from the George Washington University.
I didn't actually know that.
That's what got me into health in the first place and digital health in the first place. And so Kaushik was talking about harm reduction, and that is a big topic that we talk about when we do program development. In fact, when you're doing global health or public health program development, there is a rule, and it is an ethics. It's just a globally understood ethics rule, and the IRB will check it on it if you don't have it. But if there is an intervention that you already know prior to the experiment that can be helpful to a population, you actually have to offer it to everybody in which you the experiment. So that then starts posing problems between like control groups and study groups.
Right.
But that is a decision that the global ethics community decided upon, was that if it is going to benefit, especially if it's going to improve health, you can't withhold it from people. And so I take that philosophy to heart, and I take it with me everywhere I go. Even now that my career has sort of pivoted and shifted a bit into other things, that harm reduction is always there because it's applicable to anything that we do, whether it's healthcare, whether it's finance, et cetera, right? And so in Silicon Valley, I think Kaushik is right, and Nicole, you touched on this too, is that there has been historically been an attitude of bills and scale above all other costs and think about repercussions later. Even when it comes to fines, so, you know, breaking rules in which there is a consequence, namely a financial consequence, a fine, it is pretty standard of practice for a lot of companies standard business as usual to break rules and pay fines so long as we are hitting our goals. So there is a level of acceptance of bending the rules, and the rules are there for a reason, within the culture of Silicon Valley. And I would think it even permeates beyond Silicon Valley, but it's certainly here. And so, yes, that culture is definitely there. Now, to the degree of which it starts to harm people and populations varies, right? And so now we're in the age of, accelerated healthcare, accelerated digital health tools, biomedical applications, and then layer on top of that AI, and layer on top of that, you know, blockchain, and, you know, there's always, it's going to be something else, new, et cetera. That the rules around what is, you know, what rules are acceptable to bend change, what I think, you know, week by week. And now the accelerated pace of AI, that's honestly day by day, it seems like. I think we have to take it upon ourselves. And what I mean by ourselves is that leadership of every institution needs to build in research and ethics at the beginning, at the impetus of building their business model. Research and ethics needs to be a core value that's built from the ground up at the inception of the company. If you try to do it too late, Yeah. It's harder. It's hard to move.
You're rearranging deck chairs on the Titanic at that
exactly.
point.
Yeah. Exactly. Yeah. It's easier to steer a rowboat than it is a huge cruise ship. And so I think that's something we just don't prioritize enough because people are just thinking about growth.
Yeah.
But then you end up paying for it down the line. And we see that. We've seen it. We are seeing it. You know, I don't think we need to go into the examples because they're there. But yeah, it's definitely there. And that's something that I know we don't want to do here at In Truth. I think we are operating on a different lens. And I'm grateful to this leadership team for understanding that that is ethics needs to be a core part of the business model from the beginning, especially because of what it is that we're building, the novelty of it, the implications and the impact of it is something that hasn't been seen in the world before. And, you know, when it comes to emotional health and then when it comes to what emotions govern, if we start to get into that behemoth
and what it can influence,
it's almost critical that we talk about this at every step because it really can change the way that we live, work and play.
Exactly right. Like when you just think about it purely from the fact that emotions are driving more than 80% of our behavior, right, our decision making. One company that is using emotions as a commodity, what that could mean in the greater scheme of things, I think is really terrifying if not seen through an ethical lens. You know, I'm curious, Marquesa, obviously you're a VC that sits on the side of, hey, this needs to be baked into the beginnings of every leadership team and there's an appreciation for why impact actually matters, you know, as much, maybe even more at times than profit. But I know that there's many investors that don't have that lens, and how much of this is actually the tension that exists between maybe a team that are seeing the potential harms, but the ownership of the company by stakeholders that don't necessarily value these things, and the pressure that then applies to a company to make more reactive, you know, less considered decisions. And why is it important that we look at this now more than we ever have? Because, you know, the way I see it is AI is going to put so much of this on steroids. We've already seen the impact of this. But I feel like a lot of venture isn't changing their investment thesis to match the associated risks that we're inheriting as we move into the future.
It's a great point. It's a big and it's a scary problem. And I think we've come to the point in our existence, global existence, that we can't not talk and act upon what we're seeing. And so some of those things are, we just look throughout greater society, right? We are a global society that's more isolated. We're a global society that's less connected. And we are, a global society that has essentially lost track of what it means to be human. And so, every generation, I feel like, moves further and further away from the community connectivity that we used to once have when we were living in, let's say, you know, villages.
Tribes.
And slower, where you had to get to know your neighbor because that's probably the only person you're seeing the whole week, didn't have a car to get somewhere, pick up the phone or anything, internet to message someone. It was a slower pace and you were forced to connect with the people around you. And I just don't think that, I think we're moving further and further away from that essence. Even if I just think about how I grew up compared to like how my parents grew up and how my young nieces are now growing up, you know, my father used to enjoy going outside by himself at 7 years old on his bicycle to go play with the kids outside and not come back in until it was dinner time. When I was growing up, my parents were fearful that someone would come snatch us up from the street. And so we weren't allowed to play outside. Now, fast forward to these days, trick-or-treating has essentially, at least in California and the Bay Area, disappeared. Why? Because parents don't trust their kids receiving any candy or anything that they would ingest from strangers. And so now they just have little small parties in their houses. I mean, this is real evidence of how far away we're moving
erosion of trust.
Yeah. Yes.
But I think that there's another really important point in this like interconnectedness, right, of how we used to live is the actual development of empathy, right? And I think about this a lot because if we don't have those connections and then we inherit a huge amount of power, which, you know, many tech companies do and often, you know, a very small subset of people within those companies are inheriting power that can then affect millions, if not billions of people, but they haven't actually developed, like on a developmental level, the empathy required to handle that responsibility with power. I think that paints the picture of many of the things that we're seeing right now globally.
That's exactly right. And I think that is why this tool is so important to create awareness of how far away we're getting from that. And even within ourselves. So empathy, you know, because you brought it up, Nicole, and rightfully so. I mean, I think empathy starts with ourselves.
Totally.
So, you know, you have to be grounded and whole and empathetic with yourself in order mm-hmm. to be that for somebody else. Yeah. And, you know, to be able to not just to in real time access how you're feeling, but then to understand and then the beautiful part, I think, is about illuminating what you couldn't see before around your emotions is a great starting point for us to actually build then, you know, actionable interventions or actionable corrections around how we can get back to where it is that we want to be. And that's the beauty about this technology. That is the part to not be scared of.
Yeah.
From this technology. That's the part that I think is why you and Kaushik and the rest of your team and the people around you, the investors and backers around you are really supporting this, because that is the gift that we would want to try to give back to this global society. Now, that also comes with risk factors, as any technology does, right? As any innovative, you know, new technology or feature does in this world comes with risks. And we can trace that back to, you know, we can trace that back to GPS. We can trace that back to the internet. All of those brought great benefits and great risk.
Even fire.
You know, I can see where my mom is at all times. You know, even when she says, I'm on the way. No, you're not. I see you're at home.
Yeah. These are the real risk factors we need to be thinking about.
Yeah. Exactly. She can't hide anymore. But this is why we're here. You know, this is why we're talking about this. And while I personally think that we have a big challenge in front of us, I don't think it's impossible.
Not at all.
I actually think it's quite possible.
I could see Kaushik lighting up and wanting to contribute around the development of empathy. And I'm just curious, Kaushik, maybe from your lens, where we've actually, you know, strayed in regards to what we're speaking to.
Yeah. I mean, you raise an important point around just fire, right? Fire is a technology that has inherent harm, but we've been able to domesticate fire in a way.
Literally.
Yeah.
Fireplaces in our homes.
Yeah, literally.
With any technology, there's obviously both good and harm. Mm. And I think where introduction of new technologies have missed the mark has been not knowing where to draw the line. And especially when
not defining that ahead of time.
Yeah. So. Yep. For example, I knew of machine learning from my master's degree back in 2008. So I was exposed to all of these algorithms, and I was coding a lot of this, you know, more than 20 years ago. And so for me, when OpenAI created a chatbot where it's designed to speak with you at a time when we have just come out of the pandemic and everyone's isolated and lonely, and you've got this thing that you can speak to, that to me was an extreme example of, wow, like timing, right? And so to date, I've never had a conversation with ChatGPT. I refuse to. or even like it's not on my phone. I just can't have it. Like it's not human. It's a machine, right? And so I drew a hard boundary, but so many people jumped on to it and started using it. And I think, Nicole, you pointed out that one of the biggest use cases for ChatGPT is
the biggest.
Yeah, therapeutics. Like
85% of ChatGPT users in the States use it for mental health support as the primary utility.
That's incredible.
Isn't that insane? Let's just like take
that's a
moment
wild
to really
number. Yeah. That's wild to me.
Like I'm going to bridge this to secular conditions, but if you think about it, once people started using it, they didn't have that same forethought as I did of drawing a line in the sand going, this is my boundary. So once they've started using it, there's been an ethical drift of how much do I allow, you know, an LLM to know about myself? Or and so over time, if you start talking about ChatGPT to people, they and you start talking about the harmful aspects of it, they become very defensive. And it almost replicates a heroin.
That's a really good point.
Right?
Have you guys seen the reports on like all of these people going into psychosis because that ChatGPT has told them that they're some kind of like spiritual messiah, and their like belief and investment in ChatGPT is that it's some like alien sentience that's like godlike. And I just want to highlight this because I think, you know, a lot of our listeners maybe fit more in the category of having those ethical considerations, and that's, you know, maybe not all of them, but you guys listen to me talk all the time, and if you're still listening, there's got to be some form of agreement, I would say, or deep disagreement, who knows. But you know, these are real cases in the world that are happening, and actually with a pretty high level of frequency. This is not like one in a 100 million users. This is happening more and more and more, where people are actually separated from their families as a result of the obsessive use of conversations with LLMs.
I can see it. It's accessible. I mean, listen, we've all used GPT here, right?
Except for Koshik.
Yeah. I'm like you. I'm still reserved about divulging personal information on any agent. Although, to be quite honest, it is going there and it will go there, and we can't do anything to stop it. I really do believe that. And the reason is that it's accessible. It's in your pocket.
People are indecisive anyway. I think that's a really important point.
Indecisive. And I mean, at least with GPT, I mean, I don't know, for like the one personal conversation I did have with GPT, does it ever not agree with you?
Yeah. Well, it's a sycophant. This is the issue.
It is addicting. It's an addictive response format. You know, when you just want to feel good and be built up and
be validated.
Yeah. Like, you know,
but this is the inherent issue, right? But that's by design, and actually Altman admitted to it. He admitted that it was an aspect of the design principle. He didn't explicitly admit it, but he admitted that it was sycophantic. And so you can read between the lines and say, like, okay, well, that was obviously to create that addictive, you know, conversational quality with GPT to increase engagement.
Absolutely.
Yeah, which is terrifying.
It's harmful.
It is harmful, but people don't recognize it as harmful. And I think that this is a really good sort of loop into why actually it's important to consider different types of infrastructure from the very beginning, because a lot of harm has been done. You know, social media, I think, is another example of this. Where people don't actually, they can't self-recognize that it's harming them, or that they have no reference point of what an alternative way of solving that problem is, which Koshik has named. Like, we already had the disposition to want to build these relationships, right, as individuals in society with these LLMs, because there was loneliness, there was disconnection, there was this inherent issue that created that disposition. Whereas I imagine, you know, if we wound back the time and, I don't know, went to like an old Italian village, like on the Amalfi Coast 100 years ago, and introduced them to an LLM, would they really be like separating from their inherent family unit to go and have conversations with the machine and, you know, have the machine provide the mental health support? Maybe not, right? So the disposition to this societally, I think, is a really relevant part of this conversation, to be able to use tools responsibly. And if that is inherent to our society, I agree with you, Marqueza, this responsibility needs to sit with the companies themselves to understand the landscape. But what's so, like, you know, the contradiction that I think a lot of CEOs run into is, I'm building a product because this problem exists, and I'm building a solution for that problem. So, and then I'm being pushed to monetize that solution. And then it's very hard within that context to say, yeah, but this is where we actually draw boundaries and say, we're not going to go there.
Yeah. I'm going to bring up a concept that those close to me know I love. I love bringing up this topic because it's so applicable everywhere. But incentive alignment. Incentive alignment is essential. It's a dynamic that we have to be thinking about consistently. It's one that we would think about every day, all the time, when it came to building digital health solutions, namely because our health system in the U.S. is severely misaligned when it comes to improved outcomes.
Incentives. Yeah,
it is just not aligned. And so, you know, I think that's something that we have to think about, even in this respect, when it comes to what you just said, Nicole, about how companies are built, especially in tech. Where are the incentives aligned and for what purpose? And I think it has to start there. Otherwise, the flywheel will just be, I mean, the flywheel will work for the wrong reasons.
Exactly.
And so I think we have to have hard, honest conversations. And then, you know, I'm also going to add this bit too. We need to have leaders that are willing to hold the line against criticism, against pushback, against financial challenges, and you know, investor harassment. There has to be strong leadership to say, we made this decision for these reasons and we are not budging. And I'm sorry we didn't make our numbers this quarter. I mean, we'll do better.
But here's why.
Sacrifice ethics for that. There has to be strong leadership. And I just don't think we have enough of that.
Yeah. This is a really, I think, a very, very important point. I think the leadership from the internal team to also be values aligned is a really big thing. I mean, that is a recruitment kind of necessity. It's a non-negotiable. If you're going to join the Intruth team, there's got to be an alignment, especially from leadership, of where we're going in terms of our ethics and our values. You know, I've experienced a really interesting thing on the side of impact investors. Like, I've had impact investors say, well, we can't quantify the potential impact of what you're building. Therefore, you know, we can't make an appropriate evaluation, and have been knocked back as a result of that. And what I find interesting in this is it's speaking to basically the absence of framework, right? Mm-hmm. That there's no education that currently I'm seeing happening on an appropriate level to even educate investors, especially those who would call themselves an impact investor, who, in my opinion, should be backing companies that are deeply rooted in research and ethics. Like, for people on that side of the table to be saying, yeah, but we don't know how to evaluate the potential impact of what you're building. Therefore, you know, because what that then creates is the potential, which definitely will never happen in the case of Intruth, but I think it opens the potential for companies to then go and take the wrong kinds of money who don't care about impact. And this is because I saw this so many times, it was part of my passion to work with Kaushik to put this board together, because I think this doesn't need to just exist for us internally in Intruth. It actually, someone needs to build this for the technology industry at large, or if we want to be a bit more granular, biotechnologies, because that's where kind of, you know, our investment is and what we care about. But, and, you know, I want part of the work that the board's doing to be work that we then share with other biotechnologists, with other investors who are struggling to evaluate, you know, their investments through the lens of ethics and impact. But it's crazy to me that no one is leading this conversation, because it's such an obvious kind of gap in the market. And I'm curious to hear your thoughts on that, Marquesa.
I'm actually not surprised, because I feel like it's just more of the same. It's more of the historical flywheel that we've been seeing, is that we need to focus on innovation and delivering software and growing first.
Yeah.
And then everything else, like, you know, I mean, even like technical debt. Some of the technical debt companies in these big companies are scary. And ethics take a back seat because there's not enough time in the day, you know? And so it's just again, it's incentive alignment, it's leadership decision making around what the priorities of the business is going to be and are going to be. And so you know, I'm not surprised. We don't seem to learn from past behavior.
Even when you call yourself impact focused, I mean, this to me is the thing that's like, wow.
Reason for that as well, right? What we value has significantly changed. So where money is going, mm-hmm. whether it be longevity, you know, health span, you know, all of these ideas, and actually the direction of transhumanism. So if that is what the value is, especially, you know, where the money is at, things like what we are doing, which is preservation of organic biological intelligence.
Yeah, it's perceived as risk.
Exactly.
Which
How
is crazy.
Crazy is that?
Like it's a risk to back a company that is for organic intelligence, and that really is the landscape that we're living in. And I can see why, Kez, you wanted to contribute to that, but I'd love after that to move into actual infrastructure and get into the practicalities of how companies can build in a way that actually protects against some of these issues that we're talking about. But did you have something that you wanted to share, Marquesa?
I just think it, real quick, as a sentiment. I think for those that don't fully understand A, the technology, and then B, the implications, the positive implications of technology, it's a scary space.
Right.
If you don't understand the risks, then yes, you know, it's hard to put money towards that. And it, you know, unfortunately, it's up to us to educate backers around what the potential is and to demystify those risks. But that then also takes time and energy away from us. And, you know, it's something that we shouldn't have to do. But unfortunately, if you're new in the space, and especially something as novel and futuristic as this, then, but this is why are we doing this podcast, I guess?
No, 100%. Having conversations like this, and also, you know, one of your suggestions in the beginning of starting the advisory board, Marquesa, was to actually build towards a practical framework. And I really like connected with that idea. And I would love that to be something that at the right time, when the right amount of kind of conversation and investigation has happened, that we actually start to build a framework that we use internally, but actually that we could share with the industry at large, and even with investment communities, to say, hey, if you're struggling to evaluate risk, here's a way of evaluating the ethics behind various biotechnologies. I'm excited for that, you know, and I know Kaushik is too, as is the rest of the team, to take the, you know, the downside and actually turn it into an opportunity, because I think a company like InTruth leading the charge in that conversation, bias aside, is a very positive thing, because it is something that, you know, Kaushik's background, as he mentioned, is in evolutionary biology, and mine is in, you know, community mental health, and really seeing the reality. Like, neither of us have come from the development of serial tech companies. We've come from very human-centered backgrounds. And actually, you know, if you look across the rest of our team, our head of operations has an extensive background in residential care, in mental health. It's a very, the entire team has been anchored in very human-centric values throughout the course of their entire careers. And we've come together around this idea to say, hey, the reason we believe in tech is because someone needs to build a solution that scales. And we've all run into the issues of, like, you can care so much and you can give so much, but if it's one person, you know, we're not going to be able to solve the problem at the scale required. And this, to me, is one of the best utilities of technology, right? And I think approaching it with an open mind has actually given the room, which is kind of like a, you know, an irony. I think that the areas of ignorance have actually acted as a strength because we've ended up asking questions and had areas of curiosity that I think if you had a strictly technical background, you may have actually shut down and gone in a more traditional direction.
Absolutely.
Yeah. And so that leads me to data infrastructure. You know, one of the questions that we've sat with is over the next 5 years, how do we want to evolve our actual data infrastructure to guard against, you know, potential misuse of data? And the obvious solution there, one of the obvious solutions, is to make sure that we do everything we can to keep data ownership as close to, if not entirely with, the user themselves. And Okezra, I'd love to give you to give sort of a brief background about your work with the Blockchain Society and then sort of contribute some initial thoughts around sovereign data infrastructure as it relates to Intruth and maybe even broadly for biotech companies.
My biggest involvement with blockchain was with the Silicon Valley Blockchain Society, and I was a partner there leading the healthcare vertical. So what that meant is that all deals that came through the society, and let me back up. This was an investor society where we warehouse deals. So it was investor members all the way from angel groups to private equity funds representing about $3 trillion AUM collectively. And deals would come through the society, and we would warehouse them around to our investor membership. So that's so more or less the structure. And it was my responsibility to essentially create the pipelines of deal flow for the society around blockchain health companies, to diligence them, and then to keep our members updated on blockchain health trends in the market. So that's essentially what I did for a number of years. Now, fast forward to the work that we're doing here at Intruth, I think there are a number of opportunities that we can use for both with blockchain and with AI to protect data sovereignty. But there are actually some challenges, and ironically, there are some challenges when it comes to combining AI and blockchain together in data protection. In some cases, they are at odds. And so we need to come up with solutions or some sort of data architecture to protect against those. And so
can we speak to the specifics there? Because I think listeners would be quite interested. Where are the areas where actually these things can actually act against each other?
Sure.
AI and blockchain, yeah.
Sure. So blockchain is essentially at its root cryptography. And cryptography is just math. So essentially, in layman's terms, why blockchain is considered to be so strong in terms of protecting data is that it is hard to change what data is linked together in this immutable chain. Because you'd have to go through
a number of
mathematical equations to get the right combination to break the cryptography. And the way that the blockchain technology works is that it's nearly impossible, based off of the compute power that we have at the moment, to do that successfully. So that's why
because of the amount of cryptography through the chain.
Because the amount of
and the difficulty
power. The amount of compute power that you would need to run all those mathematical equations to find the right one that unlocks the protective systems of blockchain, which I can get into. We don't have that compute power at the moment. Now, in comes
AI
and its friend, quantitative computing, which we are not too far away from. And so quantitative quantum computing, it's also quantitative, but quantum.
Yeah, it's highly quantitative, actually.
Highly quantitative. quantum computing is essentially the compute power on a scale we have never seen before. And while that is still yet to become a reality at scale, we are swiftly getting there. And what that means for blockchain is that now we have these supercomputers that can go through those mathematical equations at a rate we have never seen before, at a volume we've never seen before. And so, you know, what used to be quote unquote impossible because we don't have the power to do all these formulas at once, we soon will. And so it is possible that the compute power, the quantum computing power that we will have could
outdo the blockchain.
The cryptography that binds blockchain and makes it so secure. So that's one way that AI and blockchain are at odds with one another.
That must be very painful for companies that have gone all in on building on
blockchain. I would love to follow how
they're going to adapt.
Companies who are using blockchain for this are thinking of creative ways.
I think about the same thing with SEO, which is about to become redundant. Like companies that have just spent literally like
already.
Billionth. Yeah.
Yeah.
Sorry.
I think it is.
Sorry.
Yeah.
It was thought of at the inception of computing, right? So when in World War II, in order to decipher the German codes, they created Enigma, which was the first computer by Alan Turing. And so that was the first computer was designed for de-encryption. And so already at that time, they were thinking, okay, like how will this technology progress? And so blockchain has been the next iteration of that. But as you know, Google's third generation quantum computing chip, Willow, that is able to decrypt data that would take a traditional computer 10 septillion years, which is twice the age of the universe.
So crazy.
Like I said, we are swiftly getting to that point. It's not like a future feature.
What is the timeline? Yeah, like next few years.
I think that is the consensus. I think you'll see different things.
And when you say like that quantum computing hits like mainstream in that kind of timeline, like are we talking like literally household access, or you know, companies are going to, you know, what's the rollout of this intelligence? Do you think over the course of the world?
I mean, I think it'll be household access based off of like the technology that we already have
accessible. Updates, so, technology like updates. Yeah,
your agents are going to be better, faster. Yeah. You know, things like that. But but the companies who essentially have the quantum compute powerhouses, they'll be the gatekeepers.
And yeah,
so there's an ethics question there too, you know, about who has access to these, you know, huge quantum computing.
Who can pay the Middle East trillions of dollars to build compute farms.
A lot of big tech companies have already made huge investments into quantum computing. Yeah, we're there. I think we're at the doorstep. So anyways, that's one. And just specifically on
just that, we'll pop that. We'll come back to that later. Like just leave everyone with that. Yeah,
I was just thinking.
I'm not a technologist.
Yeah, exactly.
I'm not an engineer, so I will be following how people are solving for this problem closely. I'm trying to make friends with as many cryptographers and AI engineers as I can to understand how people are solving for this. Because, you know, there probably is a workaround, you know. I'm just not the one to figure it out.
Yeah. I mean, you could maybe create like a quantum version of the chain, right? Where the cryptography is like advanced to the level that matches quantum compute. Or is that just a...
Yeah. And I guess it's worthwhile saying like what part of the public-private key, which is what guards, you know, the blockchain, is affected by quantum computing. And it's the public key. So in blockchain security, I guess you could say, you the individual have a wallet in which transactions happen, and that is secured by the blockchain, meaning that any transactions
as seen in a crypto account, you know, that's something that most people can relate to.
Exactly. If you understand you crypto accounts and you understand how that works. Yeah. And so your so there's three parts. There's your private key, which is you. You don't give that to anybody. And this is where these are the stories you hear about someone write, and it's a long like chain of letters and numbers. So people writing it down on a piece of paper and then putting it in like safe deposit box. You know,
I did that four times when I created my crypto account, and I wouldn't be able to tell you what any of them were.
I think once. I still know where it is, though. Yeah, I keep that. So that's your private key. You're not supposed to give that to anyone. And but it's derived from a public key, and that you can essentially think of it as like the slot in a mailbox. Mm-hmm. And your private, where you like people can like put things in, and the private key is like the key to open it up, which you don't give to anybody, right?
Yeah.
And then there's the address, so the hash. So you have to tell people where your mailbox is, right? Where your wallet is. And so you give them the hash. Now, the part that quantum computing can essentially undo is the public key. And because the private key is derived from the public key, what's inferred is that that quantum computing could essentially at some point by going through all this cryptography, figure out what your private key is. And now you have both, and now they can get into your mailbox or your wallet. That's the problem.
Yeah.
That's the problem. And so, you know, how do you work around that? Well, I think we talked on one of our internal calls about using other metrics like biometrics to identify people, right? So you're not having to deal with public keys or hashes. You literally using things on your body to identify yourself. Surprisingly, this isn't like futuristic programs. Like this has happened.
Well, biometrics are used all the time, right? For identification.
Yes, but in relation to securing a blockchain wallet.
No, totally. But I'm saying it's taking an idea before. That's been used in other scenarios, even you know to unlock your phone, you know, and to apply that as the future proof system for encryption. I think is really obviously. You know, it's interesting to us. I really believe that this is where we will move. And I actually think that Intruth could actually be a layer of that biometric encryption system, you know, with, to your point, Marquez, and maybe a couple of other aspects of your biometrics. I don't know, like, you know, for example, thumbprint or facial scan or you know, whatever else. And then combining this biometric assessment can actually become an encryption layer to access health data, which, you know, I'd love your thoughts on why that's important, because I think many people don't really understand the implications of not owning health data to this degree, or the fact that actually we don't own our health data really now. You know, now that the system owns our health data, we have to ask for permission to access it. Sometimes we even have to pay to access it. And what it would actually mean in terms of a revolution for us to own all of our health data in the future, which of course includes our biometric data.
Yeah. I won't get into on why protecting your health data is important, but I think everyone that listens to this should go look up who Henrietta Lacks was and why she is important to modern medicine and why her health data, namely her cells, essentially has created the entire pharmaceutical biomedical treatment protocols that we have, and wasn't compensated once for it. And the significance of that was that she was a Black woman, I think back in the 50s. Don't quote me on that. Where her cells were taken without her permission, and because of the composition of her cells, her cells were able to open the door to what is now considered modern medicine, never compensated for it.
Wow.
Ever.
Crazy.
Okay. So that's one. But like more relatable around why you want your health information to be protected is that because that is inherently yours. You know, is inherently yours, can be used to do you harm, can be used to manipulate you.
So I think just to like put this into really human terms for listeners, right? Think about how it feels when someone close to you emotionally manipulates you, like in a sort of practical, real sense, how that actually feels, how that impacts you. Now imagine, because your data is essentially the digital copy of your emotions, if that was then not in your ownership and used to manipulate you, just to sort of anchor that in. Because I think a lot of the time when people think data, they're like, yeah, but that's not, data is not me. But we're talking about biometric data, which is your digital copy of you.
Right. Let's take a really easy example. Let's say you're applying for a job and your employer has access to your health record. Mm-hmm. And they can see that you are predisposed to narcolepsy. Could they use that to then incur a bias against you because they're afraid you're going to fall asleep on the job? Mm-hmm. Or let's say you have a predisposition to, you have some chronic illness where you are out a lot. You know, you're just out. Let's say you have sickle cell anemia. Mm-hmm. Like, that is a serious disease and people live with it, but they're out for weeks at a time if they have an episode, you know? Think about how an employer that was only in favor of themselves might use that to maybe incur bias against hiring you.
We've had these practical examples within insurance companies, because the obvious utility for insurers and insurance companies is like, give us your data and then we'll determine how much you need to pay for health insurance. An alternative that we believe is better is, well, everyone gets the same buy-in, and then perhaps through healthy behaviors, you can reduce how much you'll spend, but there's no inherent bias on the onset. But if we wanted to make a shit ton of money quickly, right, we would just sell our data to health insurance companies and say, here you go, here's the profiles of all of the people that are wanting to buy health insurance with you, go nuts, and treat the bias, you know, as far and wide as you want. Sorry.
Yeah.
Koshik.
Absolutely. I mean, the harmful examples go on forever and ever. And so I don't think it's hard to establish why it's not good for.
I think a lot of people actually don't know, right? I think it's actually important that we spent that sort of few minutes really unpacking that. Because, I mean, I've heard people say it all the time. Yeah, but I don't really care who has my data. Like, what does it matter? People don't understand the current sensitivities, which means they're not primed to think about the future sensitivities when all of us are wearing devices that know us, you know, better than we know ourselves, and what that could mean if used, you know, in the wrong ways.
So it's not like it hasn't already happened. It's happened not too long ago in this country, the United States of America, you could be denied health insurance if you had a pre-existing condition. Before we change laws to essentially make that illegal. So
what's the point of health insurance? Insurance in the States makes no sense to me. It's like the more you need insurance, the harder it is to get insurance.
Again, it's that misaligned of incentive that keeps coming back around over and over again.
It's also part of, so the medical system and health insurance go hand in hand, right? So doctors will refuse treatment if the health insurance doesn't cover that.
Yeah.
And part of that is...
My partner was telling me that hospitals turn people around from a gunshot.
Yeah, the thing is, if you progress that further, it's learned helplessness from society that they don't have agency over their own health. Mm. And so they'd rather allow a third party to govern their health. And this is why when we talk about reversing the policy and putting agency into consumers' hands.
And in the infrastructure of the technology so that that's enabled.
That, you know, is bit like, I think in one of our statements, Nicole, we have trust isn't declared, it's earned. Mm. And this has never been in place in, you know.
Standing ovation.
So just the inherent nature of people not trusting their own bodies, people not trusting their own agency for health, and they depend on healthcare systems for health.
As gods, yeah.
And the healthcare system was never about health and wellness. It was about
extraction.
Treating disease. So the inherent way the infrastructure is constructed is literally against our health. And so to rewire this into society is a major task in itself.
You bring up a good point, Kaushik, that this learned defeatist behavior is applicable. We can see it throughout society, including
everything.
Health system. There's a phenomenon called the broken window phenomenon. It's something that we also talk about in public health. a lot of these things are coming back. You can bring them back to me after over a decade out of school. But broken window phenomenon essentially was used to describe how people treat their environment if it's not maintained. And so the idea is that if everything around you looks awful and terrible and is broken, you're not going to treat it with respect. But if it is, you will. It's also, you know, we see that phenomenon also with socioeconomic income levels, that the less you have to lose, the more risks you take as a population. And that is not untrue of our behavior within healthcare and towards our own health. So this idea of creating agency is, I mean, important is an understatement. I think it's
crucial. Crucial.
It's crucial in incentivizing, and I love this word, incentivizing people to actually take more ownership and be more participatory in their own health and of those around them, and blockchain does have some beautiful features on how to do that. I've a number of use cases that I saw try to do this and successfully, where there was one company that was its model was to provide free healthcare so long as you, the patient, allowed either some or all of your data to be used for, you know, research or other things. But essentially what that meant is that you essentially had the choice via smart contracts to allow third parties to access part.
And were they compensated?
They could be compensated.
Okay.
Either financially or with services. So the idea is that you wouldn't have to pay for healthcare services, because in this country you do. You wouldn't have to pay for healthcare services because you were paying with the commodity, the money that was your health data. Yeah. And so that was one use case that I saw. But also the idea is that, you know, you do have sovereignty over your own data, because the immutability and the security of the blockchain provides that service or that feature.
Yeah.
And then you can decide. You can decide, well, you can use just my dental information to run your study, and then I'll get something for it, you know?
Yeah.
And that's all built in. That's all automated within smart contract technology of Ethereum. So that, you know, there were use cases like that. So that it is possible. It is possible. And it's not that like AI and or quantum computing / AI and blockchain are completely at odds. There are ways that they can help. It can help there. You know, AI can be used to augment the automation of blockchain. That's a positive addition. But there are ways to do that. I don't think the incentive is there yet.
There's also infrastructure like federated learning, right? Which, Kaushik, I'd love. And I could talk to you guys forever. So I'm just conscious it will maybe run for like another 5 minutes and then have to do like a part 2, 3, 4, and 5. But I'd love to just introduce the audience to the idea of federated learning and, you know, what that means and how sovereignty in the context of that particular infrastructure actually works.
Yeah, this is a very important conversation, because I see a future where quantum computing is reality, right? And whether that be in the next...
That can mean so many things, as in becomes our reality. we're plugged into a quantum computing simulation.
Yeah, so what I'm saying is consumers have access to quantum computing. That could happen within the next 3 years. The technology is already there. The chips are already made. How fast does it get adopted is only a matter of time. So that would mean there is, like, everything is public now. Like, encryption becomes impossible. And so I'm designing for a future where that is the case.
Open source. And
so when it comes to, for example, in the past, companies would file patents saying this is, something that we have created and only we can commercialize. But at the same time, with AI, that's near impossible because AI is evolving so quickly that by the time you go through the process of filing a patent, the technology has already evolved to the next state, right? So it doesn't even make sense. So when it comes to federated learning, it is not about exchanging data, which is in digital health, protected health information, personal health information, you do not want to share that. Instead, what you share is the learning that the machine has had from training on new data. So instead of exchanging data, you exchange learning. And so no personal health information is ever being exchanged. And in a world where AI is evolving so quickly, I don't see the point of creating each company creating their own ML. I see each ML learning from each other as different ML families. And similar to, how evolution has worked with, the animal kingdom, the plant kingdom, the genus, the phylum species, all of these layers of evolutionary iteration, I see federated learning from those family trees, basically. So that's the sort of future that I'm designing for, because this whole idea of protecting won't be the case in the future, bank accounts, for example. Quantum computing encrypt those, not a big deal anymore. So how do you create an infrastructure that supports basically open source learning?
So this is something that, Mike, as Kaushik and I have been speaking about this week in particular, the radical idea that what if we were to actually open source all of our algorithms and everything and actually double down on our key differentiator being sovereign data infrastructure, after doing kind of a bit of an analysis on the fact that every competitor basically in the wearable space does not prioritize this. Mm-hmm. Could that actually be the model of the future, where we build on systems like federated learning? We actually see the value less in protecting the algorithms, because to Kaushik's point, the more people try to replicate us in a federated learning model, the smarter our model becomes anyway. So actually you have the first mover advantage, and then you have an ecosystem of people that are actually improving your model. This, to me, it makes a lot of sense for companies like InTruth as we move into the next kind of decade of technological evolution.
Yeah, absolutely. What I would say is, open source is, it is a pathway towards hyper growth and hyper adoption. And we've seen that in a number of use cases historically. Obviously, I figured out is that the question then is, how do you control it and how do you monetize it? So who is benefiting from this technology being open source? And I think also what we want to think about is, how do we distribute the benefit of the ROI of this being open source? So I think there's a lot of potential there, if you can essentially protect and control the asset, or where individuals could protect and control their own assets, but people are building, are still able to leverage it to build on top of it and maybe create a market where they're also benefiting monetarily. And so that's a way to distribute the financial benefit of this tech. And I think that's great. Just want to say one thing about what Kaushik said about building for the future in which encryption is obsolete. I think that's just a great point. For me, it just clicked when you said that, Kaushik. I think it's also now ironic then that because we're coming back to like antiquated methods using like biometrics, like we're really going back to thumbprints now. That's literally the hardest thing to replicate. Who knows, like in 50 years maybe we'll be there, I don't know, but I think I just have to highlight that irony that all this tech throughout the last 100 years and now we're going back to
the basics, baby.
Identify me by my.
There is another thing that, is out there for some, especially investors, but I think about part of our mission at Intros is to actually elevate the collective, consciousness, the awareness and the integrity of a population. And as altruistic as it is, and I can't see us getting there in the next 5 years, but is there a point in the future where we've actually elevated enough as a species that the whole mentality that we would use each other's data or information to exploit one another, we actually are able to transcend these ways of being as humanity? And can we also, whilst being sensible, solve for those more complex challenges that are actually more linked to kind of the human condition and how we operate as a society?
I think we can, and I think we have the tools to do so currently.
That's promising.
Yeah, I think it's going to take it's going to take a collective affinity against something that is threatening to everybody.
Yeah, a common enemy.
At the same.
Come on, aliens! We need you, aliens. Let's reveal yourselves.
A common enemy is ourself, right? And this is what I think. I never married two terms together before, but it's making more sense now. Everyone always talks about health is wealth, but in this sense, it would actually mean health is wealth, because if we have a distributed health wallet where people earn from their health, so whether it be sharing their health data,
this is how it should be,
distributed profit from that. This is a model that I think could be self-sustaining, because take OpenAI, for example. People think they are getting so much work done by using OpenAI, but actually what they're doing is training the LLM. Yeah. And so, but they're not gaining any benefit. They actually pay a subscription to train. If we have a distributed wealth for like a digital health wallet, that people, if they choose to share their data, they actually get a kickback from that. I think this would be a really powerful way to change the digital health infrastructure.
Amen.
Yeah. I mean, think about like paid survey marketing firms, right? Mm. Or even like paid research studies.
And the technology in which they use, surveymonkey.com.
That's right.
We're coming for you, surveymonkey.com.
Yeah, I can't all the time, like, pay you $100 to answer some questions around how you use, I don't know, video conferencing. It's a crude example of what we're talking about, but it is possible. How do you get companies and leadership to do it? It's a different story altogether. I guess it could start here with Intros and the framework that we create.
Well, that's it, and that's what we hope to do with all of this. Like, if we can build it and validate it and prove it, and then be very transparent about the model that enabled us to do that, I think that is, the absolute best case scenario in every direction.
And for sure.
I know we're going to do it. Like, you know, call me a futurist, but I live in the time that we've already done it. We live in that utopia. I think we have all the risks are very important to consider in the world that we're living in today, but we have the potential actually to build a utopia together. Not just the interest team, but, you know, the entire technological industry and everyone else that's contributing to that, we have the ability to create a world that is almost unimaginable, I think, for some. And it's important that we hold that vision and, you know, to the very valuable points that both you and Kaushik have touched on, build for that vision, really reverse engineer. Like, if we're to build this utopia, we need to actually stand in those values and those decisions today. And be strong, you know, even if we get pushback. And I think that the companies actually on the forefront of these conversations are likely the ones that are going to experience the most criticism from both public and media.
For sure.
So, of course, we've solved the problems of the universe.
And an hour and 15.
I know, which is like, you know, double the amount of time that our apps usually go for. But I know that our listeners will have been super engaged. I just invite you guys to give some closing thoughts, statements, reflections, maybe some questions to the audience to reflect on as they go about their day after listening to this.
I just have one thing to say, because I've certainly felt it, and I see it around me with my friends and colleagues, that they're, I guess my little bit of advice to everyone would be, don't be scared of AI and what is coming. Instead, be participatory into how it is growing and how it'll be used. So I think there is a propensity to shy away from in a protective fashion around the scary technology that seems to be undoing what we are used to and the potential risks that, you know, that it opens up. But it doesn't have to be that way. And by the way, it is happening. That is the reality. It is happening before our eyes. And so I guess the question is, like, how, you know, for each one of us, how do we want to participate? Do we want to be passive and let things happen, even though we have opinions and, you know, interests around how it evolves? Or do you want to get involved? And there are so many ways to get involved. Something as easy as just keeping on in touch with what's happening day to day with the evolution of tech, with AI and how it's being used, to actually joining boards like this, where you are, you know, first hand influence into how the tech is being built in real time and everything in the middle. And so, you know, like Ilya said, it's not a time to be scared and shy away. It's a time to get involved.
I love that. Actually, Marquez, whilst we have you know, any reflections on that note to maybe investors, specifically impact investors that are maybe nervous about where to put their capital at the moment in this kind of very unknown landscape?
Yeah. So fear is just a lack of understanding. And so what I would say, low-hanging fruit for any investor that is hesitant or fearful, is to dig deeper into educating yourself around how AI works at a fundamental level, and how people are using it in product development, in business development, and for personal use. And then, you know, how you would use it. And I think that alone would bring so much more understanding to the potential benefits of AI, demystify risks, and then also, you know, identify real risks that, like I said before, they could get involved in, or at least be asking these questions when they're diligencing AI companies. So I think it's just continued education, but it does take effort and energy and time.
Yeah. Love it. Thank you. And I hope that inspires, you know, anyone that maybe sits in that camp to lean in. You know, I think it's a really important message. I said in a talk quite recently to impact investors, actually, I really believe that where you put your capital today is a vote for the future that you want to see come to life. It really is that important. I think we're beyond a traditional mindset of, okay, let's get a 10x return in 5 years. You know, if you really want to be on the leading edge, this is about considering the future that we're shaping in amongst all these other decisions, you know, that a company and investors have to go through to do their diligence.
I just want to end with the note that one of my long-standing core values has always been preservation of organic biological intelligence. And I'm so honored that this is part of our values as a company as well. And as part of that, I think most tech companies lack this responsibility. They similar to how we started this conversation, build first and deal with consequences later. Mm-hmm. We don't have that option, because we are a company that is about emotional health. And we already know how tech companies mine our attention, our, you know, instincts, our impulses for addiction and for repeated use, for doom scrolling. ChatGPT, the interface, is the next iteration of doom scrolling. And so for us, if we are about emotional health, by definition, we have to think about harm reduction, mm-hmm. and not addiction, and not, you know, dependency on technology. So as a company, I think we are in this beautiful position of dictating the future of tech. And for users and for listeners particularly, I want everyone to actually reevaluate their ethical boundaries, because so much ethical drift has happened that if we talk to the same person back in, say, 2010 about, you know, the talking to a machine, they'd find it really absurd. But today, if you talk about talking to a machine,
everyone's defending GPT.
Exactly. So
don't talk about my therapist like that.
Exactly. And people become, like, they actually become so offended as if you've insulted their wife or something, right?
Yeah. In some cases, that's true. People are marrying replicas.
Yeah. That is wild. So I'd want listeners to reevaluate their ethical boundaries and perhaps put some boundaries or draw a line in the sand for yourself, so that, you know, you keep harmful technologies at arm's length, literally.
You guys, this has been a very dynamic conversation. I'm already eager for part two, but I just want to thank you both so much for your time and attention. Marquesa will put links to Perium in the show notes so that everyone can check out the awesome work that you guys are doing to support minority communities to be financed. And I'll also direct the listeners to any work that we're doing, kind of, that we want to make public in the future regarding the Research and Ethics Board. I know that these guys will be super eager to follow along with anything that we publish. But yeah, you've given everyone, I think, a lot to think about. And I just want to say thank you so much.
Thank you. Thank you for having me.